Hello, it's been a while, and I wanted to make a video, which is really going to be a reading of an article that I wrote. I'll have some more videos coming out talking about larger projects I'm working on. They're writing orientated, but we'll also finish up where I started with the series on what's happening with Israel. But for this, it was prompted by a direct message that I received about some environmentalist actions that I had been a part of in the Pacific Northwest. And I thought about myself and reassessing some of my assumptions about politics, but also myself too. And I superimposed this onto syncretic politics of today, stemming from the 90s and narratives that surround the 90s. I combined personal experiences and activist and underground music scenes as they overlap for me to larger political and activist trends at the time. And it led me to incorporate a brief section of about a Holocaust denier that I've had communication with in the past, Rob Miller, as kind of a case study. And so I concluded with some opinions about research and self-assessment as well. Overall, the thesis is that red-brown, syncretic politics, their positionism, and actual collaboration between left and right was in the 90s and still is today fairly small in the United States. Instead, what exists is a continuation of a trend that has existed previously, but really, I think, picked up in the 90s, or at least we could pinpoint on the timeline to march through history the 90s of the legitimization of conspiracy and populist rhetoric in left spaces that we see today in the contemporary modern spaces that opens the door somewhat inherently to reactionary ideas and beliefs. So it's not so much that large amounts of leftists are migrating to the right or did in the 90s. Instead, it's the flawed way of thinking that allows for similar messaging and manipulation of that messaging to traverse political spaces, especially online. And kind of maybe, next to that or superimposed on that too is self-reflection about these things and how conspiracy thinking works, the mechanisms in it, and how it can even apply to research that that I engage into. Okay, so I'm gonna read this. I will stop and give some commentary. However, it's fairly long, so I'm not going to go too in depth, or I'm going to try to not veer too far off from the article. There might be some places I skip over. It will be linked in the video and audio if you're interested in reading it. So this is from the Right Podcast Substack. I know Substack's not a great platform. It's just where my stuff is right now. I also have things on the same things on the website too. The title of this article is Breaking from Research, a Personal Reflection on Syncretic Politics in the 1990s. I'm also going to apologize up on top. The scroll bar on the right side is very small. So if I bounce around, it's that's why. This post is different from my usual research-heavy writing. Sometimes I need a break for self-reflection. The topics I often explore, like the populist right, red-brown politics, and new directions for the Western left, involve not only political analysis, but also personal introspection. After all, I am part of this Western left myself. Once the more obvious crossover themes are explored, like the responses to COVID or global events such as the Syrian Revolution and Russian invasion of Ukraine, deeper, more personal layers emerge. Recently, someone asked me about my past experiences with radical environmentalists, and how they might connect to modern reactionary groups like eco-fascists. I was a bit unnerved because I'd never considered myself anything but left-wing, understanding the limitations of such categories. This question made me reflect on how I might have unknowingly been drawn to what now would be seen as reactionary politics in my youth. This reflection led me to consider these experiences within the broader political context of the 1990s, examining both the positives and negatives of the era. This post will explore these reflections and their implications. My experience on the far left has followed a typical trajectory within the US and Western context. It wasn't until I pursued an education in history and social science that my perspectives began to change and expand, leading to a profound shift and deeper self-reflection. In retrospect, I see that some of my past views were unexpectedly aligned with populist ideas and conspiracy theories, which I now recognize as dangerous. Populist and conspiratorial thinking aren't unique to either the far left or far right. Today, they also appear in mainstream politics, especially on the right. Reflecting on the period from the mid-1990s to 2000, both personally and politically, it was a formative time. What made the 90s different was the specific ideas and overlap, or perceived overlap, between opposing political views. For me, it was about being a teenager seeking meaning and authentic experiences through music and activism. For broader political movements, it was a time when both the foundations for contemporary radical activism and some of its problematic aspects were being laid. Music was a big part of my life and central to the activist scenes that I was involved in. Punk rock and hardcore dominated my music interests during the era, and this subculture introduced many to anarchists and leftist politics. Patches of bands like Crass, Discharge, Nausea, or Amoebics were ubiquitous at shows, alongside messages about anti-capitalism, environmentalism, anti-racism, and anti-authoritarianism, to name a few. Later in the decade, other genres like post-metal bands such as Neurosis began adding layers of esotericism and multimedia performances to these ideas as society inched closer to a new millennium. The mixing of music styles and messages reflecting a similar mixing of activism and politics. Many factors contributed to the mixing or rise of political synchronicity in the 1990s. One significant factor was an increasing recognition of the authoritarian nature of the Soviet Union and its eventual collapse, which left many on the Western left disillusioned. The idea of scientific socialism rooted in Marx and Engels appeared to have failed to many. Once institutionalized, it often felt elitist and disconnected from the real struggles of the people it was meant to help. In response, the left began searching for new ways to address modern problems. This involved revisiting older ideas and exploring new concepts. When disillusionment with the Soviet experiment disrupted the keystone of class consciousness, attention shifted to other established protest movements, from environmentalism to feminism. Each of these movements brought its own unique history and identity. Together, they formed a movement of movements, united in opposing the universal challenge of responding to the new unipolar world. A growing interdisciplinary approach in the humanities was influencing academic institutions, encouraging collaboration between departments such as history, political science, and literature. In 1989, Kimberlé Crenshaw's paper, Demarginalizing the Intersection of Race and Sex, introduced the concept of intersectionality, describing how various forms of discrimination like racism and sexism intersect and overlap. This interconnected view of identity and oppression also began influencing activist spaces, encouraging greater collaboration between previously separate movements, such as labor rights and environmentalism. There were also protest views against the unipolar world from the far right, albeit in very different ways. Their perspectives often emerge from Christian evangelical angles, anti-Semitism, or far-right conspiracies. With their existing literature, networks, organization, and messaging, they can provide ready-made slogans and critiques for those seeking alternatives to the concentration of global power. Looking back, the music and activist subcultures I was a part of opened doors to positive causes, but they also carried more ambiguous and at times problematic influences. While bands like Nausea focus on somewhat specific activist topics like animal rights and environmentalism, other bands use vaguer language regarding the people versus the elites. At the time, I made assumptions about what this meant without considering other contrasting points of view. It was a situation ripe for populist conspiratorialism. The only missing ingredient was to have a malevolent actor. Populist rhetoric is interesting because it can appear anti-intellectual and anti-establishment, even when it comes from those very sources. For example, Noam Chomsky became popular in these circles, even having excerpts of his lectures mashed into samples from songs like Propaganda's track State Lottery. I was completely unaware of his genocide denialism at the time, instead being versed in his writings on topics like the Zapatista movement. I also viewed the world through a Western-centric lens, even when critiquing the West. My understanding of how global activist communities perceived contemporary events was limited, shaped largely by what Western voices, albeit alternative ones like Chomsky, told me. On the broader activist scene, anti-globalization protests emerge as a major focus. They occurred against the backdrop of the Soviet Union's collapse and Francis Fukuyama's notion of the end of history. The dominance of free market economics and neoliberal policies appeared inevitable. Free trade agreements like NAFTA were signed, and international organizations such as the World Trade Organization and the International Monetary Fund became targets of criticism from both the political left and the right. Although this criticism came from both ends, it still contained some overlap. Superficial similarities, such as populist us versus them mentality, took shape, even when them was often chalked up to various quote-unquote elites. Conspiratorial mechanisms existed in both perspectives, explaining why events that were rapidly changing the world were occurring. These explanations introduced antagonists into their narratives, providing figures to blame. This was largely an appeal to simplicity as opposed to an objective narrative. While I still believe the sentiments were generally accurate, the way I thought and formed my conclusions back then was misguided. Like many others, I had concerns over underregulated international entities finding foreign countries to exploit their circumstances while escaping established labor and environmental laws. In this sense, anti-globalization was not against globalization per se, but was instead an internationalist effort of solidarity against various forms of exploitation. However, that message was not universally accepted, nor did it clearly follow political lines. At times, it was interpreted as anti-globalist, aligning with reactionary politics and concepts like the New World Order. While leftist critiques of capitalism and environmental concerns could be encompassed under the label, it was also used to address cultural fears, including racism, far-right anti-government beliefs tied to the militia movement, and apocalyptic Christianity, which gained traction as the new millennium approached. For those listening, I have a picture. It's a Getty image, but it's from the Jacobin website of a man at the Battle for Seattle holding a sign that says, "Stop the World Trade Organization, WTO/New World Order. Hegemony and Socialist Strategy by Chantal Mouffe and Ernesto Lacalle had been available long enough for populist efforts to emerge to unite various distinct movements. In a somewhat ironic twist, organizers began to borrow ideas such as those found in the book, like concepts of hegemony, which refers to unifying various political struggles and social movements under a common political project or discourse, even if these struggles were acting against a perceived global hegemony. Critiques of U.S. hegemony were nothing new. They span back to post-war French New Wave films to 1980s punk bands. For example, Crass's song Smash the Mac condemns American capitalism and consumerism, represented by McDonald's, for exploiting global inequality and promoting superficial Western lifestyle. The song declares, quote, "We've been occupied, culture smashed, and betrayed," and concludes with the call, "E.T., go home." Their message, centered on resisting oppressive systems and expressing solidarity with those affected by exploitation. However, it's easy to reinterpret such lyrics or protest points as a longing to return to a previous state, perhaps a more pure culture, or to highlight nationalistic themes, especially when the focus of protest shifts to vague targets like global elites or organizations such as the International Monetary Fund and World Bank, which are framed as representative of those systems. As I reflect on that time, I find myself reconsidering the intersection of personal experiences and broader political trends. Contemporary research on red, brown, or syncretic politics often points to the 90s as the moment when these ideas gained traction in the modern era. This includes everything from tankies defending authoritarianism to volkish anarchists borrowing from national Bolshevists. While I agree that these undercurrents intensified during the period, I also push back against some of the more direct links that have been made. What I experienced wasn't so much a migration from one end of the political spectrum to the other, nor was it a direct consequence of anti-globalization protests. Rather, it was the adoption of a broad post-Cold War populist analysis that facilitated the normalization of conspiratorial thinking. Still, I feel uneasy when I reflect on my attraction to certain aesthetics that, in hindsight, could be viewed as gateways to crypto-fascism, for lack of a better term. As noted earlier, music was a central element for me during that period, as it was for many young people and still is today. Hardcore punk and metal bands were blending styles. Most of the bands and people I encountered were firmly leftist, and though many bristled at such labels, it tended to be the case. But there was a heavy influence of tribalism or primitivism in the sound and aesthetic that has since spawned conversations about cultural appropriation, as well as other mixing and seeking of new styles. Symbols and world cultures were merged with 80s anarcho-punk imagery, including Norse and European iconography. This interest in past culture wasn't just in the underground, it was also present in mainstream culture. Anti-Semite Mel Gibson's Braveheart was huge, and punk shows often looked like a gathering of extras from the film. World music was also being integrated into electronic music, while conspiracy theories popularized by shows like The X-Files and movies like JFK began to seep into the popular zeitgeist. Some of this may have stemmed from paranoia and unease about a rapidly changing world, whether due to the geopolitical shifts following the collapse of the Soviet Union, technological advancements like the internet, or the approaching new millennium. It might also have been influenced by the baby boomer generation, leaving their mark on culture after getting control of institutions and media. For those listening, I have an image of someone at C-Squat in New York City, I believe, Kill City by Ash Thayer, and I have a link to that website, a series of images of squatters in New York City during the 90s anyway. Regardless of the reasons behind it, the far right had been steeped in conspiracy thinking for decades. The 90s saw some of the worst domestic terrorism in U.S. history, from Timothy McVeigh to Eric Rudolph. These figures were tied to the gun show circuit, militia movement, and Christian identity movement. This era set the stage for the normalization of right-wing extremism, which would later manifest politically in the Tea Party and ultimately MAGA. At the heart of these movements were conspiracies about one world government, which anti-globalists see as a threat to national sovereignty and individual freedom. They fear it could lead to authoritarian control, diminish distinct diversity or ethnocentricity, and erode local traditions and self-governance. This concept easily folds into Zionist occupied government, or ZOG, conspiracy and anti-Semitic theory that claims Jewish interests secretly control Western governments. Of course, you can go all the way back to the protocols of the Elders of Zion as well. But given that anti-Semitic conspiracies frequently linked banking institutions, concerns about international finance in the 1990s were readily absorbed into these narratives. There's an image of Randy Weaver from the Ruby Ridge standoff that occurred in the 90s wearing a No Zog anti-Semitic t-shirt. It's linked to the Southern Poverty Law Center. I can see how these distinct and different groups could cross-pollinate a decade later when anti-Western imperialism emerged as a core focus of protest. Building on concerns about globalization or globalists, depending on political leanings, the rhetoric surrounding U.S. hegemonic power surged. Just as critiques of globalization from the left and right sometimes overlap superficially, the same is true of anti-imperialist rhetoric, which largely depends on its framing and context. For instance, reactionary conservatives like Alexander Dugin frame Russian expansionism as a rebuttal against Western imperialism. Similarly, many Western leftists ended up defending Assad in Syria after his regime brutally attacked a popular uprising in the name of anti-Western imperialism. Such reactionary anti-imperialism dates back to Weimar Germany, where national Bolsheviks like Karl Otto Patel framed their revolution as a front against Versailles, which means a front against the West and its Eastern and Southeastern satellites. Continuing against capitalism and imperialism. Looking back, it's tempting to craft a narrative about the rise of a new syncretic politics that emerged in the 90s activism and subcultures. However, I would caution those interested in the topic not to find patterns where none exist or to overemphasize those that do. Turning correlation to causation, cherry-picking data, or falling into post hoc fallacies and confirmation bias. In doing so, I'm also reminded of the need to be self-critical in my own research as to not build narrative bridges that do not exist. Even so, I can't help but wonder how often I unknowingly flirted with populist and reactionary ideas during that time, even if only through aesthetics or casual conversation. A good example of this is an article by the Southern Poverty Law Center about the 1999 anti-World Trade Organization protests in Seattle. It is an amazingly prophetic article, having been written in the year 2000. While I find some of the descriptions to be generalizations, it provides an overview of how the right, specifically through third positionism, have been gaining adherence from the left. The article's focus on specific third position groups was somewhat off base, as groups like American Front did not massively increase their membership in the coming years from the left. What the article got correct was a general directional accuracy regarding overlap of various movements. The article asks, quote, "What was behind this truly remarkable mix? How was it that members of the far left and right found themselves facing down police together? And the answers to these questions may lie the shape of future American extremism." It goes on to reference Louis Beam's infamous quote to describe the protests in Seattle. Quote, "The new politics of America is liberty from the NWO, New World Order, police state, and nothing more." The insinuation was that leftist anarchists and far-right activists were fighting the same battle against globalism, which in my experience is not exactly accurate. I've never met anyone on the left who sympathized with right-wing figures like Beam, Randy Weaver, Timothy McVeigh, or Eric Rudolph, or seeked alliance with any of them. That's not to say that some on the right weren't attempting to court others on the left, but similar to more extreme groups today, they tended not to mix. While a common enemy could be identified in superficial analysis, who these groups believed they were fighting and why they were doing so were very different. Have an image of Eric Rudolph's mugshot from the, image, I should say, from the FBI 10 Most Wanted Fugitive list. Then, where exactly was the overlap? Well, the overlap I experienced during that time centered on non-traditional alliances, such as those between environmentalists and labor, but did not include far-right groups. Does that mean it didn't happen? No, I'm certain it did. However, it's essential to place it in the proper context. These groups never really merged, nor were there mass migrations from one to the other in big numbers. Instead, what took place, in my view, was more about the adoption and cross-pollination of ways of thinking rather than specific ideologies. Populist rhetoric and conspiratorial generalizations weren't just tolerated, they were preferred over the more academic-sounding critiques that had been common just a few years earlier. This was partially based on distrust of media and institutions, along with anti-intellectualism if it defended mainstream narrative. This trend intensified as the Democratic Party was increasingly seen as out of touch with much of the left, particularly in the 2000s. The rise of social media injected this process with steroids, and outside events only further accelerated this crossover. Today, third positionist groups remain relatively minor in activist circles, but sources of information, messages, and framing of events are shared across internet spaces, albeit with different styles of delivery. However, political overlap in the 90s can't be denied. I remember zines selling God, Guts, and Guns merchandise alongside anarcho-syndicalist pins and Chomsky lectures on CD. And while no one I knew talked about Jewish cabals, there were discussions about bankers and international elites within the context of global capitalism. Though I didn't see much overt crossover, there was a certain openness to populism, which created space for new conspiracy theories to take hold. I wonder, for instance, how the modern Great Reset conspiracy might have been received or dismissed by groups both left and right at that time. The SPLC article also references the National Revolutionary Faction in Britain and the appearance of neo-Nazi Matt Hale at the Seattle protests. While I think the SPLC exaggerates the political overlap to fit a narrative in the article that they were writing, I can't deny that the signs were there both in mainstream culture and in subcultures, hinting at what was to come. Rather than the physical merging of groups or migration of supporters, the external divisions largely remained, but the ways of thinking, analyzing, and interpreting the world began to shift. These changes can be tracked and analyzed today by following the flow of specific content throughout social media and media personalities. And I realize now that to varying degrees, I was part of those initial shifts, whether through music, aesthetics, or vague political affinities. In the late 90s, I briefly rode freight trains and squatted in a few different areas, but in Portland, Oregon. In reflection, I can see how some of the SPLC's critique of what I call leftist populism existed, particularly its description of how the 1960s back to land ideals were repackaged into the leftist rhetoric of the era. This mindset influenced my own travels. I grew up in the Northeast, where these ideals were widespread and entrenched, with easy access to hubs in areas like Vermont, Massachusetts, upstate New York, etc. However, once I hit the road, politics became vague and secondary. The reality was much less political. Many of the people I met were addicted to drugs or alcohol, or victims of various abuse. This was outside the urban centers and country co-ops, but on the peripheries of society. In that context, ideological consistency, much like my then strict vegan diet, tended to fall by the wayside, even if unconsciously. And I have two images of pictures that I took on a freight train. I'm not sure where, I think in Idaho. But I do know that we were going through Glacier National Park, if anyone's interested in that. And one of the pictures has my traveling partner with me. I quickly understood my place of privilege and how various people treated me. Because of that, I began to gain clarity on some of my ideals and assumptions. I remember hitchhiking through either Eastern Oregon or Idaho, looking like a typical crust punk while my friend was going through heroin withdrawal. We weren't the most appealing to passerby, but eventually an old pickup truck pulled over and a driver waved us into the truck bed. We were both thankful and jumped in. He sped down the road, taking sharp turns and blasting 80s metal. My friend, even in the pangs of heroin withdrawal, had to laugh at the situation. When we finally arrived in the small town, the driver stopped to let us out. He came around the back to wish us luck in our travels. I shook his hand and noticed swastikas tattooed on his knuckles. Both he and his companion had shaved heads. In that moment, I realized why he picked us up in the first place. It's because we were both white. I thought about how that might have turned out differently if we weren't white men or cis white men at that. And I have an image of myself from that era too here. Another story from the time stands out, and I mean, there are many, but this is included because it's kind of what prompted all this. Someone asked me about it. Radical environmental movements, especially groups like Earth First, were part of the activist landscape. An SPLC article mentions them specifically. The radical right has added other ideas into the mix. More and more, its ideologues applaud the actions of terrorist groups like the Animal Liberation Front and sometimes violent deep ecologists like those in Earth First and the Earth Liberation Front, which claimed the $12 million arson of a Colorado ski resort in 1998. Though I never had direct contact with Earth First, at least as an organization, I did visit a group in Eugene, Oregon called Red Cloud Thunder. They were a breakaway they explained it to me that they were a breakaway. However, I've heard some different points of view on that since then. But they were a breakaway from the Cascadia Forest Defense, sometimes called the Fall Creek Tree Sit. The group was somewhat publicized with articles featured in the LA Times and other mainstream outlets. The Sierra Club posted an article with some interviews of those at the camp. I believe that I recognize a few of the pseudonyms in that article. And there's not much information I could find on the group. I'm sure it's out there, but I did find some old pamphlets that were scanned. So I have an image of some of the Red Cloud Thunder pamphlets and links to it. It was an intense experience. A friend and I were blindfolded and driven 30, 40 minutes into an old growth forest where we were dropped off and escorted to a camp. The people there taught us skills, like rappelling down trees and managing tree sit fears. We sat around campfires, we drank alcohol, we listened to music. Black metal, Amoebics, Neurosis were all staples, along with various local underground bands. This is somewhat close, so Detestation, stuff like that from the Northwest at the time. There was never any discussion of violence that I heard, and certainly nothing pointing to right-wing rhetoric. I can't speak for the radical right's applauding of actions of people at Fall Creek, perhaps, but the people there wouldn't have welcomed it from my experience. If anything, the vision of any right or left politics was more aligned with loggers and the logging company versus protesters. Black metal's problematic history with white supremacy is well known today, though it wasn't explicitly discussed in my experience at the time. Still, people did overlook aspects of the genre like murders and church burnings associated with some acts like Emperor. I find Neurosis interesting in retrospect because of its esotericism is what I say, but and symbiology. These types of bands left a lot open to interpretation and projection regarding politics by listeners. That's not to compare bands like Emperor and Neurosis. For example, Neurosis took a firm stand against Scott Kelly when he was accused of abuse. This contrasted sharply with black metal bands that overlooked or even shielded criminal members. But regardless, there was something more in tune with this music and the era, at least in these environments, than overtly political bands like Crass or American punk like Dead Kennedys and things from the 80s. The best way that I can describe it was a general sense of populist authenticity as opposed to the tinny political lecturing. It feels like that reflected broader sentiments of these activist movements at the time as well. I reflect on how that sentiment influenced my worldview at the time and how it might manifest in 2024. It seems like such populist authenticity, in quotes, would have made me vulnerable to red-brown messaging, which is more accessible today through social media. I also think about what drew me to that kind of music and aesthetic, wondering if it's similar to what attracts young people to reactionary media today. It makes me question whether this indicates a certain disconnect within myself and thinking about people who become drawn to such messaging. In some right-wing and third-positionist rhetoric, I see a search for truth and authenticity, which often leads to nationalism, racism, and anti-Semitism. But I also recognize an internal pursuit within myself for authenticity through left populist rhetoric and music that transcended politics, veering into esoteric or neo-Gnostic realms, and wonder if these could be opposite sides of a similar impulse. I think about overlaying that on the broader leftist sentiment of the time, the willingness to oppose even progressive establishment forces, and what that meant in material terms as opposed to intellectual or identity-driven ones. Even some of the things that, you know, I got the time in the article, for instance, I talk about tattoos, which don't seem like a big deal, but my tattoos essentially depicted industrial civilizational collapse mixed with Celtic art from the Book of Kells. And I was particularly drawn to these along with other crust and Gothic aesthetics. At the time, these symbols didn't strike me as anything other than ideas that I had about the world and aesthetics that I liked. Since then, the right has co-opted a lot of European pagan imagery, and much work has been done with this phenomenon, especially regarding eco-fascism. Regarding this, I can see how researchers could link these things into a narrative about either the populist left or early inklings of eco-fascism. While I didn't personally experience syncretic politics in that camp, I now realize that the aesthetics I was drawn to have in some ways been co-opted by the right. And it's a fallacy to suggest that people who enjoy these aesthetics are all of a sudden members of the far right. But again, I do wonder what exactly the initial draw was, which was in my mind apolitical, and how that might be analyzed today by an objective source, someone not myself. It's important, again, though, to just emphasize that I didn't see anything in the camps that indicated that type of thinking. I did link an article called Against Green Reactionaries. And I think it's really good because it gets into elements of black metal, Satanism, esoteric authors like Julius Evola. And I suppose, you know, that's maybe where some of these crossovers happen when we start looking at some of these designs and aesthetics, and we talk about civilizational decline or yeah, this is when cycles become involved, and this is where esotericism, I think, does kind of or definitely has an open door to link in. It didn't for me. I didn't know who Julius Evola was until like 5 years ago, to be honest. But you know, looking back, I can say, okay, so like I see where some of this stuff might have been able to have a foothold, right? I often reflect on how right-wing groups portray themselves as Volkish and the implications of that. In particular, I think about the National Bolshevist critique that the German left was too abstract for workers, making it seem detached, aloof, and inauthentic. Notice I use the word authenticity a lot in this. This makes me consider what initially drew me to certain ideas, perhaps a pursuit of authenticity over academic discussions or third-party organizing at that time. While it would be too simplistic to claim a direct cause and effect, I find myself pondering the desire for authenticity in politics or subcultures. And instead of forcing connections that weren't a part of my own experience, I focus on what motivates people to follow such vastly different ideological paths from what might be, you know, similar starting points. I've always been perplexed by individuals like Keith Preston, who claims to be an anarchist but speaks at white nationalist events. It's a clear contradiction, but over time I've understood how some people end up on this trajectory. My own experiences with anarchism were intertwined with anti-fascism and anti-racism, but for others, that wasn't always the case. For many who ended up going down different roads, it seems that conspiracy was often the Trojan horse for reactionary ideas. And if I were to edit this, I would actually, instead of using that Trojan horse narrative, use the nested egg narrative. And I'd instead say the largest egg is actually populist kind of rhetoric, the acceptance of populist rhetoric. And within that is the toleration or open embrace, but acceptance in general of conspiracy theories or conspiracy thinking, that way of viewing the world. And then opening that is where we find reactionary ideas, because it's very seldom that you go down that rabbit hole and come out the other side an anti-fascist, right? You tend to be in a reactionary place. There's a spectrum of what that could mean, but you don't generally come out talking about anti-racism, for instance. An example of this is Rob Miller from the bands Amoebix and Talcross. As mentioned, music played a significant role in the broader scene, and at the time, one of the most prominent bands, at least in terms of patches and shirts or maybe lore, was Amoebix. They are often regarded as the godfathers of crust punk, and their apocalyptic imagery and anarchist rhetoric resonated with a diverse audience, both during their active years and afterwards, leading to a cult following. I was certainly a proud member of that cult. Amoebix is interesting to bring into the conversation, even though it had disbanded by the mid-90s, because they were hugely influential, coming from the UK anarcho-punk scene, but never really belonging to it. They were comparatively dark with apocalyptic imagery and a less overt political message. Instead of specific politics, they offered a critique of authority and advocated for anarchism with slogans like "No Gods, No Masters." Lyrics would sometimes delve into esotericism or use concepts like that of nature to combat oppressive systems. It was undoubtedly shocking when Rob Miller, the lead singer and bassist of Amoebix and later Talcross, shifted towards right-wing conspiracy theories later in life, ultimately ending up in the realm, as many do, of Holocaust denial. It's hard to express how unbelievable this seemed to fans. It contradicted the anti-authoritarian and anti-fascist values that Amoebix stood for, making this shift feel like a betrayal of those principles. While still disappointing, Miller's descent into conspiracy theories and eventual embrace of Holocaust denial isn't entirely surprising. The two often go hand in hand, along with many other reactionary beliefs, which make the acceptance of conspiracy on the left concerning. That said, it's important to note that Amoebix, the band, never endorsed any of these ideologies. Rob's brother, Stig, who played guitar in the band, stated that Rob's later political views had nothing to do with Amoebix. And I have this quote that from Stig saying it's, all BS, essentially. And also the band Talcross, which had members from some of the, more popular crust bands in the 90s, were also generally shocked by all of this. It came to a head when Rob decided to put a Holocaust denier as an influence in liner notes for an upcoming Talcross album. Relapse Records, which was going to release it, dropped the band immediately. And everyone in Talcross basically said, "We have no idea. Rob never told us about this. We didn't know what was going on, and we don't accept any of this." So they were really left out by Rob on that. After the Talcross fallout, it became clear that Rob's bandmates are blindsided by his decision. And I have some statements by them too, disavowing it, of course. "I can't say that I know Rob, but I've had brief communications with him over the years via email and social media. I've never met him in person, though. Others with closer ties have also commented on the topic, and I link that here. However, I've communicated with him after the incident to try and understand how he seemingly went so far off the rails. And this was tricky because I think he's a great case study in who he is, where he came from, what he meant to scenes, and indirectly even activist scenes, and his political, you know, trajectory. So I think he's a good case study for this, and he was willing to talk to me too, which not many of these people aren't. However, there's also the conflict of what do you do with all the things that he said? Because he communicated with me, and he was pretty open and transparent. So, you know, I had to think about what am I going to do with this? So back to the article. I'm not going to de facto platform him by offering up specific quotes, but in general, he is under the belief that he's continuing on the same mission he always had, and that no censorship or caving to social pressure should stop him. Ideals that he claims are consistent with the messages from Amoebix. I find Rob interesting in that it seems some of the core values and ways of thinking existed as he traversed political spheres. From my impressions of him, he long had a moral certitude regarding his sense of betrayal by various institutions, such as propaganda and formal education. He employed patternicity to draw conclusions about how the world works, and he's distilled the us versus them from that populist kind of rhetoric even further down to the individual versus essentially everybody. And I think there might be some psychology there. But while doing this, he employed the simplification of complex scenarios to create grander narratives. And those grander narratives all had that malevolent actor or actors, group of people behind the scenes forming a conspiracy. In Amoebix, he implored people to, quote, use your head and take control in the song Chain Reaction. And now he believes he's doing just that by unraveling the quote-unquote greatest lie, which is predictably recycled and debunked claims of Holocaust denial. He proclaimed our land, sea, and sky, and the power remains, using nature as a resilient revolt against oppressive tyranny, and now discusses immigration through the lens of ethno-nationalism. At the end of Arise, and you won't see it in the, if you look up the song lyrics, you have to listen to it, but at the end of Arise, he mocked and condemned the audience of his shows. And today he continues that condemnation, labeling them the woke mob. That was another through line as well. He engages in fallacious reasoning, indulging in anomaly hunting, and misunderstanding or rejection of probability, all expressed, though, in a poetic manner. And I hate to breeze through some of these things like anomaly hunting and rejection of probability, but these are things that exist on the left too. And these are things that can even exist in their own ways when we're doing research. So I think that it's connected and was kind of an underlying thesis for this writing. Rob may claim to transcend the left-right paradigm, but in truth, he echoes right-wing conspiracy theories and talking points, ultimately leading to anti-Semitism. He's a valuable case study because his shift toward anti-Semitism was so dramatic, yet it also illustrates how red-brown thinking can develop fueled by conspiracy theories. In his mind, he is non-political. He's beyond the left-right paradigm, which you often hear sometimes in modern red-brown thinking kind of rhetoric, as opposed to 70s and 80s stuff. The idea that, you know, the left-right paradigm is no longer relevant. Well, I didn't gain much insight from discussing the topic with him. I now have a clear understanding of how he personally ended up in such a troubling and disappointing place. If anything, it just proved how dangerous and flawed conspiratorial thinking can be, and why it needs to be combated in all spaces, even when deployed against seemingly shared targets. it isn't more authentic because of its contrarian nature. It doesn't provide special insight like that of the Gnostics. It isn't above politics because it generally brings people to the same reactionary stances, and it has nothing to do with free speech. It is a logically flawed way of thinking, presented as a cheat code to knowledge that results in real life pain and suffering. However, the issue of anti-Semitism on the left also deserves attention. In the spirit of Amoebics, not Rob, we should not bend the knee out of fear of condemnation, nor overlook the issues within our spaces or ourselves. There is plenty to critique. A starting place for learning about anti-Semitism from the left, titled Anti-Semitism Viewed from the Left, a reading list, was provided to me by Spencer Sunshine, who recently wrote Neo-Nazi Terrorism and Countercultural Fascism, The Origins and Afterlife of James Mason's Siege. I haven't read the book, but I think Siege is very interesting if we're talking about like transcending the Zine age to the digital age. I think I Don't Speak German did an article like specifically on that. Or podcast, I should say, not article. If the analysis is sound, then populist rhetoric and conspiracy are unnecessary. They add no value to the argument, but serve as gateways to harmful ways of thinking and conclusions. Unfortunately, they are effective in driving media engagement, leading to greater exposure and potential profit. For this reason, I would question the motivation of any individual or group that employs them. The Holocaust denialism that Rob engages in mirrors a soft genocide denial found in works of ostensibly leftist authors like Edward S. Herman, which became foundational in modern Western anti-imperialist thought. This approach enabled authors in the 90s to justify their revisionism regarding a genocide in Bosnia, Kosovo, and later Rwanda. That methodology, framed as both academic and a form of speaking power to truth, is disturbingly similar to how Rob presents his quote-unquote facts. This type of denialism offers a partial admission, giving the appearance of reasonableness before moving to question, downplay, or trivialize other key aspects in historical revisionism. For example, Rob didn't deny the existence of concentration camps in Nazi Germany, but he did question the use of gas chambers. So it's this idea of, yes, the bad thing happened. However, you know, the crazy parts didn't really happen. And that's actually just kind of propaganda to justify continued war. Similarly, authors like Chomsky didn't deny the existence of war crimes or even camps, you know, during Bosnia and Srebrenica, during the Bosnian War. But he did deny that there was genocide. So again, yes, there were camps. People were treated badly. However, this wasn't, you know, an ethnically or religiously targeted events or something like that. That's crazy. That's actually just war propaganda to justify war. And in both cases, the way of viewing things and the structure of thought is the same. And what really ties them together is the existence of a outside, again, malevolent kind of actor that's pulling the strings. And ironically, in both, it's the same. It's the West. It's, you know, it might be a little bit different given the change from 1940s to 1990s, but it's essentially the powerful imperialist West, whether that's the U.S. or the Atlanticist or Versailles, etc. It's very similar in the way that the thought is structured, presented, organized, and justified. However, I know that that's kind of a bombshell thing to say. So I just hinting that's that type of thing is what I'm working on in the background and why I haven't been as active with videos. Superimposed on top of this quote-unquote methodology is what might be described as a conspiracy theory or theology of Western dominance. I say that not in dispute of Western imperialism and global influence, but instead how the phenomena are analyzed, discussed, and presented. Too often, rhetoric bleeds into populist generalizations that are reminiscent of those that gained traction during the 90s. Again, these tools are unnecessary if the analysis is accurate and open the door to flawed ways of thinking that can lead to confusing, harmful stances as we see today in many political spaces. To return to my initial point, I believe it's crucial not only to critique what you oppose, but also to critically examine your own space and yourself from time to time. Reflecting on the underground and anti-globalization activism in the 1990s, I see both an inclination to overstate left-right crossover, but also the groundwork for future shifts. What happened wasn't so much a physical migration from one side of the political spectrum to the other in my experience, nor a direct result of anti-globalization protests, but rather the adoption of a broad populist analysis that paved the way for a normalization of conspiratorial thinking. That way of thinking is often a Trojan horse for reactionary positions. I reflect on my own privilege and how it benefited me in certain situations, whether in my interactions with police or with people who could have easily taken advantage of me. And while I didn't hold reactionary views, at least to my knowledge, I recognize I was likely in precarious proximity to them. This interests me because it could help explain how people find entry points into the very subculture and politics that I've spent much of my life countering. I reflect on how close I might have come to adopting dangerous beliefs, realizing that some of my earlier assumptions were naive, to say the least. These reflections prompt me to think about how it might shape my future research, especially in terms of avoiding incorrect methods that can echo conspiracy style thinking. I'm increasingly aware of dangers posed by conspiracy theories and populist rhetoric and how similar starting points can lead down vastly different paths. I truly respect anyone who stands up against these forces, particularly in today's digital world with its growing social pressures and constant scrutiny. There is considerable validation and profit to be gained from embracing syncretic rhetoric in digital spaces. Exploring connections between the far right and potential left-wing cross-pollinization is vital. However, while this research is important and can also serve as personal reflection, it must be done objectively, avoiding the very pattern-seeking and flawed thinking it aims to expose. Okay, so that's the article, and you know, there's a lot there. If you wanted to just hear the article, you're dismissed. I was considering making a separate video to kind of add context to this, but I'm just going to add it to this, and it's easier. People who listen to my content are used to very, very long things. So I didn't want to get too far off track while reading it because it took me almost an hour to even just read it. But kind of unpacking some of this stuff now, and I won't take more than 30 minutes, I don't think, to do this. Yeah, so, you know, a lot in the videos that I've made, I feel like I kind of, it isn't that I hit a wall, but I felt like I kind of said what I wanted to say, and I could do more of that and I could go deeper, but there were some other things going on that I wanted to kind of switch to. And so I did, and that involves writing. And that's what I've been doing for the past year. And I've been working with an editor in Islamabad, actually, who she provides me some great counter, I guess, perspectives on things and insight. But it's a very long process. And like many people who do this, this is not my main gig. So it's slow going. And that's what this like initial beginning is kind of talking about. But a group that is no longer active on Twitter or X or whatever the hell it is now. I think it's the Anti-Maupin Archives. We were chatting about ecofascism, and I had talked about, you know, some of my experiences, and they were, you know, the person that was communicating with me from that was really interested in what I had to say, and then this kind of it tied back again to someone else who I was talking about Israel and Palestine with after October 7th. And it got me thinking, like, you know, I always just kind of assumed that what I was doing was this like left-wing type situation. And, you know, no one at the time gave me any reason not to think that. But then I started thinking, well, I mean, maybe that wasn't totally the case, and maybe I should think about it. And that's where all this kind of started from anyway. I'm kind of scrolling through, you know, a lot of this. So yeah, you know, I talked about how the 90s, I feel like were unique. I mean, of course, every decade is unique, but it felt unique because so many things were combining. Like in the world of art, there was so much that was combining. You know, I remember that was kind of like the installation art age, when you were immersed in rooms of things, and there would be digital media and sculpture and all these different things happening, and how it was like that in music too, and not just in the music that I was interested in, but in broader music, you know, as well. So many mainstream, I mean, that was the age of grunge and everything, but there were so many weird influences like funk and stuff going on and mainstream, and it was just a lot of meshing. And along with, you know, a lot of that meshing, it was Eastern concepts, you know, secular Buddhism and athletic yoga were mainstreamed into suburban households, and, the Travel Channel, Discovery Channel, you know, were doing these shows about people traveling all over. So it was very much this meshing, and it felt like a time of many different things, you know, combining and coming together. And, that was one big influence, and, you know, kind of coinciding with that was the collapse of the Soviet Union and, the kind of abrupt new global order of Western, you know, true Western power. And at least if we're talking in terms of power hegemony, so, you know, I think that both of these things that occurred kind of facilitated the amount of crossover that happened in activist thinking, not just spaces, but in ways of framing and viewing and organizing. So that's kind of what I'm talking about in this section. The movement of movements is something that I heard a lot about, like, during that time. I go into some academic things too. I you know, talk about intersectionality and I get into Lacalau and populism. I you know, for me personally, that's kind of maybe lower and not incidental, but you know, important. It's part of the bigger story, I suppose. But yeah, with, you know, by that time too, in many Western spaces, you know, even before the collapse of the Soviet Union, a lot of people were turned off by Marxist-Leninism anyway. And people had already, you know, begun to look in different places and different spaces. And just so happened that when it all came down and it all crashed down, people were looking for new things in this highly integrated world, and a new burgeoning, you know, internet as well. So all these forces were coming together. It was somewhat unique. And then something that I find interesting that I haven't, you know, spent a lot of time writing about, but the end of the millennium too, coming to the 2000s, and, you know, maybe personified in like fears of like Y2K and things. But there was, even for people who were, you know, agnostic, atheistic, didn't have any, you know, preconceived notions or beliefs in any of this, it was still like part of the cultural zeitgeist. So it was just a very unique time, and maybe it was because of all that, you know, conspiracy theories were so mainstreamed and populist rhetoric was becoming so mainstreamed, or You know, it could also be, I mentioned that the boomers gained control of media. And I mentioned like the X-Files and JFK, all the Oliver Stone stuff that was, you know, popularized. And all this stuff that was just on TV, all the weird alien stuff. A lot of these things coming that had previously existed, you know, coming to the surface and becoming mainstreamed and popularized. And, you know, for a lot of these things, there is nothing inherently wrong in them, you know, alone, but they all had ties, you know. I mean, you can go far enough back and, you know, to, if we're talking about esotericism, you get to Julie Zavala and traditionalists, or if you want to go on like a different road of spiritualists, you get to like Madame Blavatsky and the kind of racist concepts, you know, that came out of those early times too, and even within you know, the weird alien stuff, there's racism and the Nordics and David Icke, you know, kind of came to be. So it's just a crazy time, you know, where a lot of this stuff was not just around, but becoming normal. You know, it was like on TV at 5 o'clock after school. So, you know, I kind of merged that with the concept that the far right had already been at this for years. So while people were beginning to search for things and look for things, the far right already had the books and the pamphlets and the organizations and the networking and the infrastructure there for a lot of this. And in the US, I mean, that goes back a long way. I think, I mean, there's two big strains in my way of viewing it, with like maybe Christian identity and then the Confederacy. I have a whole video on that, conspiracies of the far right, so I won't like rehash it here. But long story short, like, they already had a lot of this stuff down. A lot of it had to do with consolidation of international power, consolidation of banking institutions, of course, loss of sovereignty, all of these things that people were talking about. And when they're not done in with good analysis, when they're done generally, loosely, in broad, you know, general terms, populist rhetoric, that's when these things can kind of seem to have similarities and blend into each other. And that's the danger that one of the big dangers I see with kind of accepting and acknowledging, you know, populist rhetoric as being okay. It's not that it's like dangerous on its own, but it is the idea that it dulls things down to a point where everything becomes a broad generalization, you know, and so sweeping generalizations and fallacies become okay all of a sudden. And that's how we can get into some pretty bad spaces. So, you know, that's what I'm talking about here. I talk about, yeah, some of the weird crossovers, Noam Chomsky being in the beginning of punk songs and stuff. Let me see if I can get to the next big part. You know, that Crass song is interesting, Smash the Mac. I link it. It's a good song. I like Crass. But it's interesting because, I mean, Crass was, you know, the quintessential anarcho punk band, you know, from the 80s. Leftist to the core. Steve Ignorant's still out there doing it. God bless him. But there is some interesting things in that song that I think illustrate maybe what I just said about this kind of generalization. You know, so the song is talking about essentially Western imperialism, right? But the way that, you know, the quote that I picked out, now most of the song is not like this, right? But the quote that I picked out, we've been occupied, culture smashed and betrayed. That to me is like very interesting, because if you look at that in a very general, broad, populist kind of, you know, view of things, I mean, that could very well, you know, apply to conspiracies today about, you know, Europe being taken over by immigrants. Like, what do we mean that our culture was smashed and betrayed, for instance? Because to me, that signifies like a purer culture in the past. And I mean, it's not utopian. There's left and right utopianism. To me, it's more, you know, this idea of anytime where things are said to be degraded, you know, that gets a little wishy-washy for me, into perhaps forms of traditionalism, and definitely the type of language that third positionists used more in like the 60s and 70s and stuff. So that was interesting to me. And even that, you know, if you want to talk about national Bolsheviks and, you know, the Switzerlandization of Germany at the time, meaning multiculturalism, the Vulcan and significance of the Volkish people and how the communist parties didn't get it. They were aloof and who had their nose in the books too much to understand the salt of the earth, you know, people. That, you know, that, so anyway, that's why this kind of, and I know that that's not what the authors of the song meant, but I think that if you're viewing it again, generally in this populist kind of rhetoric of generalization, it can mean both things if you want. And that's the danger in that way of thinking. And you know, that ET go home. Yeah, you know, I mentioned some of the blending of styles and the iconography, and you know, there have been discussions about this since you know, especially like the horrible tribal tattoos that people were getting in the 90s and cultural appropriation of that with Pacific Island culture. But you know, I was more thinking about myself and yeah, you know, there was a draw. There was definitely a seeking for answers and solutions, and maybe idealization of the past, and based in some primitivism for sure. And you know, when it comes to this idea of like civilizational collapse, I laughed when I said that because I know what that means to people now. If, you know, at the time it felt kind of, it didn't feel inevitable, but it did feel like we were on the wrong path. And I'm trying to think like a 16-year-old, you know, would think. And it did seem like you could only go so long, you know, before systems would collapse. It wasn't like advocating for terrorism or something like that at all. But, you know, I mean, I think that without fully understanding the consequences of it, or maybe without fully understanding at the time how that could be leveraged, I mean, you are talking in a way about cycles, and I think about the, you know, like how concepts like, you know, the Kali Yuga and stuff are adopted by fascists. It's a tricky thing because just because fascists co-opt things doesn't mean that they own them, you know, those ideas. And it doesn't mean that, of course, the original cultures that embrace them. Now, that particular thing is a little bit sketchy with fascism anyway. But I guess what I'm trying to say is that it's a nuanced conversation. And I think today, because of just so how the right is so co-opted these things, it seems very black and white. And I guess I'm suggesting that maybe it shouldn't be. Just because people co-opt things doesn't necessarily make them the owners of them, I guess is what I'm trying to say here. But it was interesting regardless, because it did show like the inroads, you know, the way that people could maybe get their hooks into young impressionable people and draw them onto these different paths, because that's always been something that's been an enigma to me. I never understood how people ended up believing this BS. And at like no point did I ever entertain any of it. And I never understood why anyone did. But and at times I think I just kind of condemned them as individuals. And at times maybe that's the thing to do. But thinking about this anyway, it kind of made me reflect on, well, you know, perhaps there's a little bit more nuance to it than just that. C Squat. I think that's C Squat. I was at C Squat for a second, more just to see what it's all about than actually staying there. And then the far right stuff with Timothy McVeigh, Eric Rudolph. Yeah, I'll do something separate on this sometime. I feel very passionate about this. You know, I'm looking at this picture of Randy Weaver, and I just, you know, it's infuriating how I recall like the made for TV movies in the 90s making this guy seem like he was some type of hero or at least some type of neutral figure that was, you know, being abused and oppressed by the government. And they left out all the BS that he was involved in, all the white nationalist stuff that he was doing, the fact that he had isolated his family because, you know, they had this belief in this end times kind of Christian fundamentalism that essentially created the scenario that he found himself in, which, you know, a lot of these things do. It's just very similar to Waco, Texas, and how the government was criticized. And, you know, perhaps it should have been. But at the same time, when you're in a doomsday cult, you tend to facilitate the reality that you want. And that's what Randy Weaver did. Like, I'm sorry, he's not a hero. But on top of that, these figures like Timothy McVeigh and Eric Rudolph, what astonishes me is how they're just not in the political zeitgeist anymore in the US. And I mean, body count wise, Timothy McVeigh committed the largest domestic act of terrorism in the US, domestic act of terrorism. If we're talking about, you know, the modern US, we're not talking about like genocide of Native Americans and things like that. And Eric Rudolph, I mean, my God, he set off a bomb at the Olympics. Could you imagine if someone set off a bomb at the Summer Olympics this year and had a note saying this was Antifa? Could you imagine what the political ramifications and cultural and media interpretations of that? Not only now, but I mean, for people still talk about the Weather Underground, you know? But here we had this person who is tied to the Christian identity movement, who wrote openly about cultural Marxism, about the New World Order. He attacked the Olympics because he thought it was an expression of multiculturalism, of this new unipolar kind of one world organization. He wrote a book that I read. I don't suggest you read it. That kind of gives his side of the story. And my God, it a lot of it sounds like political commercials for mainstream Republicans nowadays. It's crazy. I guess it's crazy to me because of how it shows how far right American culture has gone, even though the proclamations are that the left is insane and this and that, of course. But the fact that, you know, the writings of a terrorist that has to have, you know, them from prison that has to have them posted on a, you know, a Christian terrorist website too, because no one else will publish it, which they shouldn't, is in line with many mainstream GOP candidates, at least in terms of messaging and the things that they're saying. The fact that they set up a bomb at not only the Olympics, but at a gay club, at numerous women's clinics throughout the South. And these people are kind of just lost to history, you know, on the anniversary, maybe but they're not cultural touchstones. And it amazes me that they're not, because I think that they should be. New World. Okay. So something else, globalization, globalists. To me, and this is my own way of thinking, I've separated these two things. To me, anti-globalization is not anti-globalist. They're two different things. And any attempt to combine them is false, essentially. Anti-globalization was not anti-internationalist. It was pro-internationalist. It was pro-solidarity with the global community against the foreseen exploitation that was coming of labor, of environmental laws, of child labor laws, of many different things, right? The other side, anti-globalists, that's the Alex Jones world. That's the Christian fundamentalist world of Revelations and seeing that, you know, the devil would arise, the dragon would arise, and that there would be peace on earth under this world ruler, and how that's bad because that's actually the devil, and, you know, things like that. That's the Turner Diaries. That's loss of sovereignty. That's minorities taking over and immigrants taking over and anti-Semitic conspiracies about how, you know, Jewish people are facilitating these things. They're two totally different things. But if you engage in this generalized populist rhetoric, again, where analysis isn't specific and doesn't matter as much, well, you're speaking in generalizations and, hey, you know, they're both against the elites. Well, who are the elites? Like, what, you know, specifically, what do we mean? And that's the kind of annoying but precise language that we really need to use. And, you know, maybe to apply it to things today, yeah, I mean, you know, then it was about globalization, and of course there were the touchstones in place of international banking, of consolidation of global order, of people being seen as pulling the strings, whether it's the people in Davos or Jewish people or what have you. There was a lot of things in place in these critiques that you could have this superficial kind of layover. But honestly, you know, no one wanted to talk about it then either, and no one wants to talk about it now. No one ever wants to talk about anti-Semitism on the left or potential conspiratorial thinking on the left. But you see it today when we talk about these conversations that need nuance and precision. For instance, like if you're going to talk about, you know, the Anti-Defamation League, you know, or AIPAC, and influence on American governance, and the influence that maybe the leader of Israel has on elected officials in the United States. And you start talking about, well, who is native to that land? And you start talking about things like DNA. And you talk about, well, you know, well, what about the Khazars theory? And, well, you know, Ashkenazi Jews. This to me is very dangerous stuff when we start engaging in this type of discussion. And I've seen it, and I've written some things about it, but I have a lot more I was writing about that kind of got put on the side about this. I'll return to it someday. It doesn't mean that you don't protest what is essentially a far right Likud party creating, I guess, manifesting in real material terms a greater Israel at what can, I think, be legally defined as genocide against Palestinian people, you know, regardless of whether it's defined by everything within the definition. I think it can definitely be defined as that. And I think a lot of people can agree with that without argument. That's one thing. However, when we take the very specifics, which perhaps might be the legal definitions of genocide, for instance, like in the ICC. And if we move away from that to these more generalized things that get play on Facebook, you know, like, hey, these guys coming over from Brooklyn are supposed to be the natives in this land or something like that. You know, Hasidics coming over from the U.S. are taking over and they're claiming to have, you know, privileged this land. It's very dangerous. And it's I think it's also very dangerous with some of the some of the framing of non-Ashkenazi Jews as well by leftists in the West. Maybe without having them actually involved in great numbers in that discussion, if that makes sense. That's something that I've seen as well. It doesn't mean that we can't apply lessons of anti-racism or even lessons learned from like apartheid, you know, things like that to other global events. But it gets sketchy, especially when people are just saying things and they don't understand, they don't really understand the modern culture, the modern complexities of this, especially when we're talking about nuances, like for instance, you know, who actually supports Likud, you know, and things like that. It gets very complicated. I'm already off topic, but anyway, coming back to this though, I think that that's why this type of reflection is important and necessary. You know, at that time in the 90s, no one wanted to talk about this stuff. No, we're not anti-Semitic. We just don't want, you know, companies to be able to escape Western established labor laws and go to other places in the world and exploit people and kids and, you know, things like that. But it is clear when you step back and you look at it, you know, sentiment aside, but looking at the structure of thought that there were some troubling similarities, I suppose, which is why it's not the sentiment of thought that it's really about, you know, or the organizations that it's really about. To bring it back to like the Palestinian Israel, you know, in the beginning, after October 7th, there are some articles about, you know, far right groups trying to join protests, and they've always done this. They were doing this in the 1970s, 1980s with the Palestinian cause, and like those people need to be immediately ejected and renounced, and you know all that. But that's they're still a very minor piece of it. Just like third positionists were a minor piece in the 90s, to be honest, or you know, right wingers trying to infiltrate leftists. Instead, it's the way of thinking that I think is more dangerous, because especially in the digital age, as messaging can go from many different sources, and you know, this can be tracked, and I've tracked this in past videos. You can have someone like Andrew, you know, Anglin saying things that are very similar to things that Max Blumenthal is saying, that can be very similar to things that you might find in, you know, pretty leftist spaces too. And that type of thing is, I think, potentially more dangerous. Okay, I'm already breaking my 30-minute rule here, so let's see what else is big. I don't have much to say about riding freight trains. Red Cloud Thunder. I wasn't there very long. Or I was there. I was there for a little while, but I wasn't very involved in what was happening, like in terms of the organization. So I can't speak with the organization. You know, I was there for a little while and I met people and I learned how to do some of the things that they were doing. But it wasn't, you know, I couldn't really speak to the ins and outs of the organization. The idea of authenticity, I think, is important too. You know, I'm going through this part about imagery, eco-fascism, maybe going back to some of those concepts of natural cycles, you know, the Volkish idea, you know, all these are kind of, they're interesting to me because it's the only way that I've been able to find any kind of in to where when I think about things like in an introspective way, I could say, okay, maybe I could see how someone who is seriously misguided, you know, maybe young and open to influence or whatever, could maybe get down this road. Yeah, I guess I don't have anything formulated to say about that. It's just more of a general observation of that's why it is interesting to me. It's also kind of interesting because, you know, I do wonder, you know, thinking about these things from other people's points of view, just what how they might interpret them, how they might interpret things that I was interested in, or even some of, you know, like my tattoos and stuff. Rob Miller, it was surprising that he talked to me a lot, because generally these people don't. And he was very open about what he believes. It was interesting. More what I got out of it is really more are things that I'm not really interested in sharing, to be honest, because the things I got out of it were, I feel like were more insightful into who he is as a person, as opposed to any broader, you know, bigger political or social things. And it's not to, you know, just be like, he's an a-hole or something. It's more along the lines of like a psychological seeing, putting the pieces together. So instead of seeing someone that was in this band that was signed by Crass, who came out of this anarcho scene, who was embraced by, you know, the far left forever, and then coming out of the woodworks and saying stuff like, you know, the Holocaust was an exaggeration. It you know, that seems very stark, and you're like, how'd that happen? I think I just gained more insight into it wasn't an abrupt thing, and that some of the ways of thinking existed even when he was on the left. It's just the way that he was applying those methods of thinking, or what he was applying them to, were different. Which again kind of brings me back to like the whole point of this, of how important that really is. And really just how scary it is that these flawed ways of thinking are normalized, like completely normalized and mainstreamed. And in fact, combating them is seemingly, you know, at least in many spaces, a minority position that's dismissed. But yeah, I mean, that's really kind of what I got from Rob. Some of the sources in here are really great. The one on ecofascism and the reading list for anti-Semitism on the left are really good sources. So I would encourage anybody to check them out. And then, you know, I think maybe at the end I talk about, I'm going to go back and actually update that analogy of the Trojan horse, that the egg thing. I like that better. But at the end of it all, you know, I came to a lot of technology later, even when I was young, because I was outside, to be honest. And it's not a value thing, it's just true. I was out and I was doing stuff. You know, I came to YouTube late, because I didn't really care about it when the first few years it was out. And I came to Twitter very late because I really didn't have any use for it. And when I came to Twitter, which now is only a few years ago, I was just blown away by what I saw. And I guess I'd say this, you know, I've met a lot of people that have been very helpful and have, you know, helped me find information and sources and talk me through things. But even with some of the people who I've met, who aren't necessarily looking to make a bunch of money, you know, they're not grifters. But there still is a pressure, at least from what I perceived. It's not like anyone told me this, but just the way that the system works. with the networking that's necessary to really, you know, boost your numbers, and you want to boost your numbers and the people that follow you, because then you get more eyes on what it is that you're trying to say, and you might really think what you're trying to say is like the truth and it's good, and maybe it is, you know, but it does feel like the inherent structure of what Twitter or X is can make people, I suppose, be risk adverse. Because, you know, if we're all really having open conversations, that's going to involve self-criticism. It's going to involve constructive criticism of our peers. We're not all going to agree. And it's really, you know, these things exist in real life organizing. These things exist in real life mutual aid efforts. You know, social media is somewhat abstract in that way, and that direct human connection isn't there. It's not necessary to be there. So because it's not necessary, I do think that people can, you know, see these things that I think are necessary. Again, self-critique, disagreements, critiques of others, you know, within the same circles, as being risky. Because if, you know, if you're blackballed, or if people start not following you or dropping you and saying, oh, F this guy, all of a sudden, you know, whatever influence you feel like you had goes through the floor. And this thing that it feels like you have built up and spent a lot of effort in creating is, you know, no longer useful. And your platform feels like it's gone, even though it's not. I mean, you can, you know, you can touch grass, I suppose, and go out. But I do feel like it's difficult, you know, to especially someone who is, you know, someone you admire, someone who's maybe a published author, or someone who has a whole bunch of followers, or, you know, a media figure that you like. It's hard to disagree with them in a nuanced and educated way, because that's not how the algorithm works. It's not nuanced. So at the end, I do, you know, say, I really do respect anyone who stands up for things that they think are right, and for things that they see as wrong in their spaces. And that might even mean migrating to different platforms, you know, to Mastodon or Blue Sky or just leaving it all behind. You know, I've known groups that have done that too. They just don't want to deal with it, social media. So it's a hard thing. And I think maybe instead of condemning people who have reservations about doing, you know, about that, it's more useful to say for people who are, you know, interested in getting involved in this type of thing, to understand what they're getting involved in. Because there is a lot of weird and unique social pressure, you know, involved in these groups. And I think it can be at times, it doesn't mean that always is at all, but it can be counterproductive to having good conversations. And those good conversations, you know, your best of friends are the friends that will tell you when you're wrong, right? And so it can be, you know, counter to that type of activity. So that's what I had for this. It's a long one, like they always are. I'll have some other things come out soon. We have to wrap up Israel and Hamas in October 7th. It's already been a year. And I have to get some updates on some of the long form. At this point, I'll just call them books that I've been engaged in and what I've been doing instead of making these videos. So those will be coming. I'm not going to say soon, but they'll be coming. All right. So if you made it this far, you're a trooper. And I appreciate it because, you know, it means that you're thoughtful and invested in these things. And that's really what the world needs. That's what matters.